Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today we discuss the 39th president's policy goals, foreign, but first domestic. Carter's focus on the environment was groundbreaking and well-documented. His lesser-known successes included requiring banks to invest in low-income communities and legalizing craft breweries. But he was dogged by a bad economy and an oil shortage, and he felt it all was having an impact on the American spirit. So President Carter decided he needed to reach out to citizens and give a speech addressing how Americans feel. Vice President Walter Mondale and others were deeply opposed. According to Jonathan Alter's book, Mondale called the speech draft, quote, the craziest goddamn thing I've ever read. Carter could not be swayed. Here's a minute of the address given in July 1979.
It is a crisis of confidence. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will. We can see this crisis in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives and in the loss of a unity of purpose for our nation. The erosion of our confidence in the future is threatening to destroy the social and the political fabric of America. The confidence that we have always had as a people is not simply some romantic dream or a proverb in a dusty book that we read just on the 4th of July. It is the idea which founded our nation and has guided our development as a people. Confidence in the future has supported everything else. Public institutions and private enterprise, our own families and the very Constitution of the United States. Confidence has defined our course.
Although the speech was well received, it was described as the malaise speech, although Carter never used the word. And as Jonathan Alter points out in his book, Domestic Policies, Carter actually won more than he lost. So why don't we know this? Possibly Carter's awful relationship with the press. We'll talk about all of it with Jonathan Alter. When Carter was running for president, he ran on a platform that sounds very familiar right now, sounds a lot like how Joe Biden ran. He called it a healing process that would draw on the character of the American people. When did Carter realize it would be reasonable for him to think he could be president?
Well, I think his ambition to be president was really accelerated by his meeting all the big shots in the Democratic Party in 1971 and 72 when he was first governor and they were candidates for Democratic nomination in 72. And they would pass through Atlanta and often stay at the governor's mansion. And he's thinking, I'm smarter than these guys. I know more about where the rubber meets the road as a governor than they do as senators, because these were, you know, people like Edmund Muskie and George McGovern, later Ted Kennedy. The one he liked the most was Hubert Humphrey. But, you know, some of them drank too much and he didn't think they were as good as he was. And so he thought, I can do this. But if it wasn't for Watergate, I don't think he would have ever made it. An obscure former governor at 0% in the polls. He started running almost immediately after Nixon was reelected in 72, secretly, because he knew that it would be seen as preposterous for him to be known as a presidential candidate. In those days, that just wasn't in the realm of possible. But then when he left the governorship in late 1974, which is a full 2 years before the Iowa caucuses, which he basically invented, they hadn't been significant before Carter, he's unemployed and he can campaign full time. And even though he's still just an asterisk in the polls, he turns out he's a really gifted retail campaigner. And over time, he ran a campaign that was perfectly in sync with the times, with the post-Watergate hunger for moral leadership in Washington. And in that sense, when he said, you know, I'll never lie to you, we need a government as good as its people, these themes really resonated in 1976. And although Nixon wasn't president, so the comparison to Trump isn't exact, you know, we were still in a post-Watergate political culture, and he would not have been president had we not been.
Carter, when he started to run for president, and this went throughout his presidency, he had this sort of difficult relationship with the establishment Washington press corps. Sometimes he would do things like, because he was so disciplined about time, he would say he's going to leave the press behind if they were late for the campaign bus or plane. I'm curious, from your interviews with him and just looking at his whole career, was that purely out of his sense of right and wrong and discipline, or was there a bit of a power play involved with the way he treated the press?
Well, I think, especially when he was younger, he was very thin-skinned about criticism. He's gotten a thicker hide in more recent years, and a little bit self-righteous sometimes. And he seemed humorless, although he could have a dry, biting wit in private, which I learned. And there were actually some very funny things that he would say. But the press didn't see that. And and the press was also loaded for bear. So in the same way that Watergate made Carter president, it also unmade him, because the White House press corps, they thought everything was another Watergate. Every, you know, silk flap, they'd put gate as a suffix on it, right? And they didn't ever give him a break. And Jody Powell, his press secretary, said, not only did we not get a honeymoon, we didn't even get a one-night stand. And I noticed that when I went back and looked at the coverage in early 1977, when, by the way, Carter was very popular. He was, at the end of that year, he was over 70% popularity in the poll. So the people at that point, before his popularity cratered, they liked him, but the press was very suspicious of him. And some of them thought he was a phony, which clearly not true, you know. And they were uncomfortable with his wearing his religion on his sleeve, even though he was a strong believer in separation of church and state. And many of them regretted it in later years. So I've talked to some reporters, like Sam Donaldson, for instance, and they feel in retrospect that they were too suspicious of Carter, too hard on him.
When Jimmy Carter became president, he brought a whole crew of folks from Georgia with him. What did he think that his people could accomplish that perhaps people who had been in Washington a long time couldn't or wouldn't?
Well, Carter took pride in being an outsider pretty much his whole life. I mean, even when he was growing up on the farm in Archery and would go to school in Plains, you know, a few miles away, population, you know, 500 at that time, he felt like he was an outsider in the big city. And that has been true for his entire career. And he took pride in being an outsider. And so he made the mistake of kind of shunning the Washington establishment. And I think he got some advice that, oh, if he's too close to the Washington establishment, that'll hurt his political brand. But he ended up alienating some people who could have been friends. And he, some of the Georgians around him were very talented, others less so. And if he had reached out to non-Georgians earlier in his time in office, he might have been better off. And if he hadn't felt like he almost had a chip on his shoulder a little bit about Washington, he might have gotten more legislation through, although I argue that he got much more accomplished than people normally remember. And there also was some anti-Southern bias involved. So, you know, the Georgians became targets in ways that, say, you know, the Irish mafia, the Boston guys who were around JFK, they never took that kind of grief. So I think a little bit too much was made of the fact that he had these Georgians around him, but it did make him more insular than he probably should have been, especially for a guy who turned out to be a real global citizen, and you know, one of the most worldly presidents we've ever had.
He made some interesting choices early on. He wanted to be transparent. He wanted to be frugal in the White House. He started wanting to sell off certain assets, like a yacht that was part of the presidential portfolio. At one point, he thought he might want to close Camp David. What did he miss about these norms? Because that did not endear him to people.
Yeah, this is a great question. He wanted to depomp the White House. And he even, you know, for a time, they didn't even play Hail to the Chief. Part of it is that he's just cheap. I mean, everybody says this. he considers waste, to be almost a moral affront. So he would, go around the White House turning off lights and turning down the thermostat, that kind of thing. So what he missed is that the presidency is a theater, and you don't want to be smaller than life. You want to be larger than life in the presidency. And I don't think he really had the capacity to do that on some level. And by the time he tried to do it, it was arguably too late. And so these things that he had done to almost shrink himself early on just hurt him. And in terms of the yacht, it was called the Sequoia.
Right.
It had been used by presidents for many years to squeeze members of Congress. Like, they'd have them out on the yacht and they'd, give them some liquor and get them to vote their way. And Carter didn't do that. One of his aides told me that his idea of hell was to spend, 2 hours trapped on a boat with a congressman. That cost him, because while he won a lot of votes, he also lost a fair number of votes. That gave him one less tool in the toolbox of the presidency. But he did, keep Camp David, and he got a lot done there.
Mm-hmm. On his second day in office, Carter issued Proclamation 4483 and granted unconditional pardon for those who evaded the draft during Vietnam. Why would he do this so early? What did he want to accomplish, but what did it end up accomplishing?
Well, so this to me is a good example of the many things that Carter did and he's not given any real credit for. So there were all of these young men who had fled to Canada, mostly some cases to Europe, to avoid serving in the Vietnam War. And the war had ended officially a couple years earlier, but this problem was about 10, 12 years old of draft dodgers. And a couple of senators went to outgoing President Ford, who had been defeated, and said, "Why don't you pardon them?" And he wouldn't do it. Carter, who had so much more at risk politically than Ford, decided this is a way to bring some closure to this sorry chapter in our history. And he did it. And as Bob Kerry, the senator, at that time was living in Omaha, told me recently, it was one of the most courageous, important decisions involving a war that an American president had ever made. Obviously conservatives didn't like it. Barry Goldwater, Dean of Conservatives in the Senate, said it was the worst decision he had seen in all his years in the Senate. And interesting to me was that some people on the left didn't like it, because Carter, as usual with him, it was a measured decision, and he declined to to pardon deserters. So he pardoned draft dodgers, but not those who had deserted their units. And since the ones who had deserted their units were more often poor, and it was the slightly more affluent and more white draft dodgers who went to Canada, you know, he got some criticism from the left. I think we're going to see that kind of thing happening with President Biden, where, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. Like, he makes a decision that's pretty good but not good enough and gets slammed for it. But often, if you're getting hit from both sides, it means you've done something right.
My guest is Jonathan Alter. The name of the book is His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. I think if people think about Jimmy Carter and his accomplishments in domestic policy, obviously they think about him and the environment. I was very interested in this little nugget on page 314 about the judiciary. Carter appointed 262 federal judges altogether, by far the most of any president until then, and more than any of his successors, including Donald Trump, in a four-year period. First of all, why and how? And how are we now, today, affected by this moment of Jimmy Carter appointing 262 federal judges?
Well, the courts were overcrowded, and so Congress passed and Carter signed an omnibus judicial act, which dramatically expanded the number of federal judges. So he was just fortunate enough to be president when the court system was expanded. He was unfortunate enough to not appoint a single Supreme Court justice, the only president who served at least 4 years who never did so. But he diversified the federal bench. He took the United States throughout the government, but especially in the judiciary, from tokenism to diversity. So he, for instance, appointed five times as many women to the federal bench as all of his predecessors combined, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And she was asked later, you know, when did you know you wanted to be a judge? And she said, when I heard Jimmy Carter say that half the human race, you know, should be considered for judgeships. Because before that, women weren't considered. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a few, very few. You know, it was extraordinarily rare. So he changed that, and he did something comparable with African-American judges. And so he really transformed the federal bench. And in, you know, most of them are now retired, but for the last 40 years, the Carter appointees to the federal bench have shaped our world. And people don't pay very much attention to decisions below the Supreme Court, but they often are enormously influential in terms of the way the law is interpreted.
What was Jimmy Carter's biggest domestic policy success and his biggest domestic policy failure?
Well, I would say that his biggest success came in the area of energy and the environment, although it looked for a long time like he had failed on energy, because his program went through piecemeal, big chunks of it were defeated. But he signed 14 major pieces of environmental legislation, the first fuel economy standards, the first toxic waste cleanup, on the energy side, the first funding of green energy. I think people know that he put solar panels on the roof of the White House, but that, which Reagan took down. But those were just symbolic, really, of his effort to establish energy independence in the United States. And he basically did so. It didn't happen while he was president, but eventually we have become independent of foreign oil. And it was sometimes done in ways that liberals didn't like at the time, like the deregulation of natural gas prices, which created a lot of new exploration for natural gas in the years since, but also with, you know, solar and other alternative energy. And the Alaska Lands Bill doubled the size of the national park system, adding 105 million acres of protected land in Alaska. And then many other areas, he also, in the continental United States, he also protected. So he was clearly the greatest conservationist president since Theodore Roosevelt, and he was thinking about our energy future. For instance, I found in his papers as early as 1971, he was underlining articles about what was then called carbon pollution in the journal Nature, you know, in scientific journals. Other presidents would play golf. He would read scientific journals. It's just what he liked to do. So he knew about climate change from a very early point. And if he had been reelected, it's very clear from this report that the Council on Environmental Quality issued shortly before he left office, that he would have taken steps that were very similar to the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015. So, you know, it adds a tragic dimension to Carter's defeat in 1980, because he wouldn't have, you know, gotten us off fossil fuels, but he did recognize the problem and he wanted to move to electric cars in the 80s, or at least hybrids. He was always thinking in a visionary way about energy and environmental issues, which is what a good president should do. In terms of failures, he failed to tame inflation. And he appointed Paul Volcker, who jacked up interest rates so high that it arguably, in addition to the hostages, cost Carter re-election. Volcker's way of ending inflation did not work until Reagan became president. So Volcker arguably elected and re-elected Reagan. And then I think the other big domestic failure for Carter was on health care. So he and Ted Kennedy were like oil and water, but they should have had a bill very similar to Obamacare in 1978 or 79 instead of 2010. And then I also think on the domestic side, there was an opportunity to strengthen the rights of labor unions. Called labor law reform, and Carter was for it, but he didn't put a lot behind it. You know, he came from a right to work state, and it fell narrowly short. Didn't seem like that big of a deal at the time. His unions were still relatively strong, but in retrospect, it really hurt the American labor movement.